Good morning. You're listening to 88.7 WHCLFM, Clinton, New York. I'm your host, Pete Bianco. This show is titled The Ringer. And my guest this morning is Carol Vanderstoep. Carol, thank you so much for joining us.
I'm really happy to be here. It's fun to talk about alternative ways of thinking about dentistry.
So your new book is Mouth Matters?
Yes, How Your Mouth Ages Your Body and What You Can Do About It is the subtitle. It's long, but yes.
sounds very interesting. Health is integrated by design. So that kind of sounds like some thoughts that I've been having about dentistry, like why would my body need have parts that need to be pulled out, like my wisdom teeth? So is our body designed to fall apart, or are we doing something terribly wrong?
I think we're very cavalier in dentistry about amputation and extractions. That goes all over the map. I think, excuse me, speaking of wisdom teeth, I think it's interesting to note that different cultures have different rates of needing to have them extracted, and one of the things that I've most been interested in lately is how we end up with crooked teeth, too small of jaws, and so on. How did that come about? And I don't know if you've interviewed anybody about that, but
no, I haven't.
It all goes into oral posture, and it's something that almost nobody looks at. It's getting ready to be big in the United States thanks to people like Joy Moeller, who's a myofunctional therapist, and Dr. William Hang, who is my orthodontist out in California. You wouldn't think I'd be going into orthodontics at my, you know, age, but especially having had straight teeth and teeth that function quite well. But what I did not have and what I was just figuring out, I had never thought about it either, is that I don't have enough tongue space. So that comes about through, quite often, poor oral posture. If, you know, before we even get into that, I'd like a lot of your listeners to even think about if they've considered where their tongue is at rest in the mouth, whether it's on the floor of the mouth, whether it touches the front teeth, whether it rests in between the teeth, whether it's in the roof of the mouth. You know, it's a shocking question and one that you've probably never thought about, Pete.
No, I haven't. So
yeah,
I'm just thinking about it now, and my tongue is resting on the roof of my mouth and not quite touching the front teeth. So where should our tongue be in our mouth?
That's the right answer. It's perfect. And they teach this in yoga and Qigong and so on, that absolutely the tongue should talk. Should be plastered to the roof of the mouth. About the tip of the tongue should be about half an inch back from the front teeth, maybe a little less. There's a little ovoid-shaped papilla right behind the front teeth, and right behind that is what we term the spot in myofunctional therapy, and that's where the tip of the tongue goes. And if it lies up there when you're a young person developing his facial or going through facial development, there are across the midline of the palate, going from front to front of the teeth to the throat, there's a whole line of stem cells that you stimulate to help broaden the palate.
Wow.
We have so many children here in the United States who have a lower tongue rest, and they are very, very narrow. So when they go into orthodontics, the first thing they start with is an expander. And they are not taking into account the fact that the tongue is a natural palate expander. And that's mind-blowing right there. So you get a lot of cross-sectional width there if your tongue is in the correct position. And the other thing, I'm going to go back to that tongue rest posture, but since we were speaking of wisdom teeth and I want to tie it together, I think parents might want to measure the distance between just right where the nose starts at the base of the nose and measure to the bottom of the chin when the child is at rest, and then have the child put his lips together and his teeth together and measure that in millimeters. You know, you do need a rather particular ruler, but you only want that distance to be, you know, the difference between those two to be maybe 2 to 3 millimeters. If it is more than that, the child probably does have a lower tongue rest, probably is mouth breathing, which is the other significant thing that I want to bring up as far as facial development is concerned. excuse me. If it's 5 millimeters, what happens? Now, we look at stars on the screen, and those that we say have a chiseled jaw, they have a very, very firm jawline, and the lower part of the jaw after the, you know, you have your jaw joint up by your ear, then the jaw drops down at an angle, and then it moves forward, and that horizontal, we want that to be fairly horizontal to the floor, because if it is, they're going to have more tooth space as well, more room for the teeth to erupt without crowding. So if you're a mouth breather with a lower tongue rest, you're probably going to be narrow both horizontally, longitudinally, if you will, and vertically. And the more you mouth breathe, the more that angle is going to, you know, the front of your face develops, so it becomes very, very, very long, and that lower jawline is going to, instead of be horizontal, it's going to drop to be more of, say, a 45-degree angle.
Hmm.
And, again, that has huge repercussions for how much room you're going to have for your wisdom teeth and bicuspids and so on. And a lot of times this is when dentists will do 4 bicuspid extractions. We've got generations of people who have gone through this extraction orthodontics, which means, you know, because they perceive that the upper jaw, the front teeth are protruded too far, when in fact it's the lower jaw that is not developing correctly.
Mm.
And so they'll pull those front teeth back. The person is probably a mouth breather. They'll start to have jaw joint problems. You've heard the term TMJ problems and
yes.
So on. And an incorrect swallow also will, how do I want to introduce this, in what order? In a correct swallow, where the tongue is on the roof of the mouth and the tip of the tongue is on the spot, the only thing that will happen during a swallow is that the back of the tongue drops down. No facial muscles need to move. The lips don't have to be together. Like parents out there could ask their child to grimace and just make this huge, you know, Cheshire case so they can see the front teeth, and ask them to swallow. And quite often they can't swallow, or they can't swallow without putting the front lips together, and you see a lot of facial movement, and that's more of an active swallow, which causes problems in and of itself. It causes the jaw to drop back and force the temporomandibular joint, you know, the lower condyle to kind of shove into that joint, and it just has a lot of negative repercussions that you don't want. And, of course, you do have the tongue pushing on the teeth all the time with every swallow, and that can change their position, as can that lower tongue rest. So I think oral posture is just huge.
Is there a particular diagnosis for a person that has problems swallowing that other doctors may be diagnosing as, you know, doctors who are not dentists may be diagnosing it as a certain disease or disorder where it may just be related to the oral posturing?
That's an excellent question. And later on, apnea comes into it. So that's a huge disease, and how I got to how do our faces form. But we'll visit that in a minute.
Sure.
Tonsils. I mean, I don't know that I would call them diseases, but I'm a good example of not understanding this. I noticed that my oldest daughter, when she was quite young, had huge tonsils, and I was concerned for her airway, and at some point I sensed that it was changing her facial shape. And even though I truly believed that tonsils were important, I thought, you know, this is terrible. And so, you know, we made the decision to go ahead and get them out, but that was treating symptoms, not the problem. What I should have done was gone, oh, that child cannot breathe through her nose. She has some sort of allergy. And this allergy is is what caused her to be a mouth breather. And so, of course, when you breathe in ambient air, you're bringing in so many more allergens that your body, you know, takes months to get rid of what you're bringing in through the lungs instead of breathing filtered air through your nose. And in fact, I think the nose hairs even have some kind of antibiotic function, if you will.
So breathing through the mouth accelerates allergy problems.
Yes, I would say that that's exactly right.
Wow.
And but what we should be doing is trying to figure out, you know, if they have airborne allergies. But we need to be figuring out what our children are allergic to and get it, you know, try to take care of that so that they can be nose breathers.
Mm-hmm.
And that tends to be a cyclical problem because now we get into carbon dioxide, oxygen ratios in the body. And if you want to really get down to root causes of what makes for inflammation and disease, it's having an acid system. I'm pretty sure you've done shows on foods and alkalinity and water and alkalinity and, you know, how anaerobic germs, the bad guys, tend to love acid conditions. I'm thinking yes.
I touched on it a little bit, but looking to get some more specific guests who could address that issue.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, you know, in the mouth, that becomes very important because, you know, now here in dentistry, we look at the mouth and, you know, we endlessly clean teeth, and some people have more tartar than others, and what is that? And the bottom line is some people have a lot more acidity in their systems, and in order to address that, our body has all kinds of ways to neutralize acids that are formed, but one of the primary ways is through respiration. Those people who have acidity are going to need to keep their blood between 7.35 and 7.45. And so what it does, it'll pull
pH.
Minerals out of the the pH. Sorry, excuse me.
No problem.
Because if you go outside that range, you're pretty much dead. You know, so the body is very, very geared towards keeping the pH at that particular level in the blood. But it'll mobilize minerals out of the bone into the bloodstream to kind of keep it at that correct pH, and sometimes it precipitates out in other places like kidneys, like into the plaques in the mouth if they're not removed, and so on. So of course that's a huge concern in dentistry, but we rarely address it from a systemic level.
So does that
and
mean?
I think,
I'm sorry.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
Does that mean that tartar? When you're getting tartar on your teeth, that's a sign that your body has been in a state of an acid state?
I'm thinking that plays a role in it, absolutely.
But it's not necessarily the only player or the only...
Probably not. I don't think we know all of them. But I know, for instance, those people generally who have a high sugar diet, sugars tend to make your body more acid in many ways. And... these people almost always have tons of tartar, you know. They just run acid. And then their mouth is more hospitable to the anaerobic germs, you know, so they're more prone to gum disease and so on, too. So, you know, we're always trying to alkalize the mouth or make it at a certain pH all the time, and that's wonderful, but it's hard to do if your body is not regulated the way it should be. So breathing happens to be a huge part of that because so let's talk about carbon dioxide for a minute.
Before we do, I just had one more question about the palate formation. Does the use of pacifiers for children play a role in that?
Yes, pacifiers. You know, most often those children who are breastfed for a long time learn a whole different sucking pattern. And... their tongue knows to go up in general. When you start with the pacifiers or the sippy cups or the thumb in the mouth, different sucking patterns like that, you're going to end up with a child who, first of all, they've learned to keep their tongue in the floor of the mouth. The thumb will actually, you know, we say it kind of puts a thumbprint in the mouth. It really pushes up high on the palate, and they also end up with a narrow palate and with their teeth kind of flared out. I mean, form follows function. So thumb sucking is just one of the worst things you can do for facial formation. So the sooner, you know, if you can all avoid it, that would be the best thing. Mm-hmm. But myofunctional therapists tend to help help children get over that habit. And that way the different muscles that form the face can help bring the teeth into the proper position. I just had a child who I helped with that, and the mom, before we even started myofunctional therapy, we had to have kind of a month in there where they were traveling and so on, and his flared, you know, overbite started to shift just because the lips were putting more force on the teeth than they had been allowed to do. So
what does myofunctional therapy look like?
Myofunctional therapy is learning correct oral postures and exercising the different muscles of the head and neck in a different way. For instance, a child who's had a lower tongue rest will usually have a flaccid tongue. You know, it's going to be big, it's going to be fat. You wouldn't think that it takes much muscles to keep the tongue in the roof of the mouth, but it does. I mean, and so when they learn to do that, they start getting a little muscularity. So it's just a series of therapy sessions where we work with the children so they know first how to keep the tip on the spot, and then a lot of times the middle of the tongue doesn't, you know, then we work on the middle and the back. We work on having a more passive swallow. And let's talk about a couple of more reasons why we would want to have the tongue up. If you swallow correctly, you are going to, with every swallow, the tongue pushes up on the soft palate, which is, you know, everything's connected in the body. That's where we started. The little vomar bone that runs through the nose gets pushed up a little bit, and then that's interconnected with the sphenoid bone right in the bridge of your nose, in which sits the pituitary. And so every time you correctly swallow, you kind of milk the pituitary of all the hormones it makes. So growth
wow.
hormone. Yeah, this is mind-boggling. Growth hormone, sex hormones, you know, the ones that control mineral balance in your body. So, fluid balance, it's really important. The pituitary is very important. And so a lot of times children who learn to keep their tongue up, you know, sometimes there are twins and one is up and one is not. And they're different sizes, and, you know, you teach them to keep the tongue up, and all of a sudden they go through a growth spurt, I think because they're, you know, getting some of that growth hormone stimulated, so.
And the first time I remember hearing about that was from Weston Price in Physical Degeneration. Mm-hmm. He was talking about a child who was born with Down syndrome, and he figured that the bones were pinching on the pituitary. And when he was able to spread out the teeth, that pinching stopped, and the child received a growth spurt, and it actually changed their cognitive abilities.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely, and quite often these children will have that, you know, mouth open, tongue down, mouth breathing, and if you mouth breathe. You know, I mean, all this is so related, it's hard to stay on subject, and I'm sorry about that. We're dancing around
quite
a bit.
But
let's go back to the carbon dioxide thing.
Sure.
We were taught that carbon dioxide was a waste gas, but it is far from being a waste gas. It is so important because without enough carbon dioxide, you can't pop oxygen off of hemoglobin. So you may have this oxygen running around the racetrack of your circulatory system, but if it's holding on, what good is it? You know, it's not functioning as it should. So you need a certain ratio of carbon dioxide to oxygen to be even able to properly oxygenate your tissues. That's so profound because if you think about cancers like hypoxic conditions or suboptimal oxygen conditions, and exercising. You know, a lot of people go, "No, I need to breathe." Oh no, I need to breathe through my mouth when I'm working out hard. I need that oxygen. Well, the fact of the matter is, you you need that oxygen, but you need it in your muscles. So it's a little bit of a transition, but once you learn to nasal breathe while you're exercising, no matter how hard it is, not only do you improve muscle memory, but you are getting actually more oxygen to your tissues. It's like breaking through a wall. It's really tremendous once you figure out how to do it. You have so much more energy. So
to get back to, I just heard you mention minerals and pituitary, and I thought it was parathyroid was responsible for minerals in the body, but they may both be. If you have more information, I would appreciate hearing about how these glands affect our minerals.
Well, let's just say it's an anti-diuretic. You know, there is a hormone that the pituitary does secrete that does help with. I think it does it through minerals, but at any rate, it deals with fluid balance, and that's probably the extent to which I know. Mm. But you do want all those hormones functioning correctly and stimulated properly.
And I also heard people are using the hyperbaric oxygen chambers, and when they add carbon dioxide to it in addition, it works even more profoundly.
Now, I hadn't heard that, but that's pretty interesting. Hyperbaric chambers are an interesting subject, and I know, well, let's see, let's not go there, but I was going to mention a particular athletic star who uses one every night, and I keep thinking that you would get, and this person is definitely a mouth breather, and you can watch the structure of his face changing over the years. It's very sad to watch, but, you know, he's an amazing athlete, but he would do so much better if someone would help him learn, and most of the top-level people working with athletes are starting to teach them that. But at any rate, I kind of am interested in the idea of having these people breathe ozone through, you know, as it's bubbled through oil.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me like it would have the same effects as a hyperbaric chamber, to be honest, because you increase the number of, I don't know, you talked to Dr. Malika recently, I think. Did
yes.
he talk about how it increases the number of mitochondria in each cell? The mitochondria are the energy generators for each cell.
I don't believe he mentioned that, but
yeah.
I think I did see him talk about that in a lecture that I had watched. But unfortunately, in an hour, we went all different places but there.
Oh, there's so many places to go with ozone. You can just talk about it for days, and he's the mastermind. He's great. But I like that benefit. You know, you have more energy per cell, and then you upregulate your immune system through your antioxidant enzymes, which are important. I mean, we all take enzymes. We all take antioxidants all the time, but it's nice to have those enzymes going that can recycle those antioxidants on a consistent basis, because then you get a lot more mileage from each one of them. So, anyway, yeah. But back to carbon dioxide, it's extremely important.
One
to the body.
Thing that has me slightly confused about the ozone therapy is I'm going through Ed McCabe's book, Flood Your Body with Oxygen, and
mm-hmm.
I don't believe that he has mentioned anywhere the danger of breathing ozone directly. But I heard Dr. Malika mentioned that, and I thought I heard him mention that in an interview, and I thought I heard you mention that also in an interview.
Absolutely, and I think that there's not enough awareness out there. Yes, ozone itself has an affinity for moisture, so our eyes and our lungs, it goes directly to them, and it definitely changes and oxidizes things there. It is not good to breathe it directly. However, there is a safe way to administer it, and that is as it's bubbled through oils, and then you breathe it, and there's a certain way, you know, that you have to do that. And I don't recommend any, this is not a do-it-yourself at home thing.
Right.
Then you get the benefits. It's not quite ozone. It changes into all these other, you know, different compounds. So Yeah, a lot of people try to do this, do-it-yourself at home ozone. I just think that's messing with messing with danger because, you know, you have these $100 ozonating devices and people stuff those in water and, you know, all the ozone's kind of coming off of it and they're making it out of ambient air.
Uh-huh.
And ambient air has 70% nitrogen in it, and so you're making compounds that are terrible. So I highly recommend not, you know, using those cheesy ozone generators.
Because you would want to be using something that's only 100% medical-grade oxygen?
Yeah, so that you have that. And then the other important thing is that the ozone generator has to be hardened against ozone. I mean, if you think about it, it's O3, so it's going to oxidize things, and you need to have an ozone generator that is not going to be breaking down itself while it's generating it so that you come out with a compound that has ozone with a lot of impurities in it.
Right.
In fact, I was just doing an article for our major journal, and I was kind of explaining that whole thing. I mean, ozone is considered a drug, and as such, it's under the oversight of medicine. And so there's an ozone, you know, Dr. Schallenberger is kind of the MD here in the United States that has his organization. And they've come up with something called the Madrid Protocol so that, you know, people aren't doing dangerous things with it, you know, basically.
Right.
So, yeah.
And I had also heard you mention that ozone can be helpful for you when you're performing a cleaning on someone's teeth.
Yes, I love all the uses of ozone. I mean, and it isn't just hygienists can use it in so many ways. But for one thing, excuse me, the premise of my book is that, you know, if you don't take care of your mouth, you're going to have some nasty germs in there that can invade the bloodstream and cause damage distant from the mouth. I mean, that's a pretty basic premise. And I talk about it from all the different inflammatory diseases and so on. So even something very, very common, you can appear not to have gum disease. You might have just mild inflammation in your gums, let's just say, without having the underlying bone destroyed. And yet, if you're not cleaning under the gums very well, and a lot of people don't even know what under the gums means, but there's a little crevice around every tooth, and that's important to know how to clean out. Because if you don't, the blood vessels there are going to be a little bit enlarged, thicker, but more porous, and the germs, which morph over time into some of the more anaerobic, nasty kind, do go into the bloodstream. And one in particular that I write about in Mouth Matters is F. nucleatum. A woman in California was pregnant and so looking forward to delivering her child. She had a little respiratory infection, so her gums got a little bit inflamed, and before long, the child was stillborn, and she called Dr. Hahn, and they figured out that what had killed it was this little germ from the mouth called F. nucleatum. It was found through the amniotic fluid in the child's brain. I mean, it goes to the weakest part of the body, and a lot of times we're unaware of the connection between the two. So for that reason, you know, just to understand that even in somebody who looks pretty healthy, I won't even pick up a probe or a curette without dipping it into ozonated oil, which can be bought. Again, you want to make sure it's from a reputable company. So I like O3 skincare. But anyway, I will use that as I go around and even probe to see if they have any gum disease. And certainly when I'm working or before I start working, I'll put ozonated oil in all the pockets. And that serves a double a double purpose because it kills the bacteria pretty much on contact. It oxygenates the pocket. It alkalizes the pocket. So after you get done, it's going to be hospitable to only the good bacteria. I mean, it's not the goal of in our mouths is not to get rid of all the bacteria in our mouths. That's not right, you know, because then here come the fungi. You know, you just want to make it a hospitable ecology.
Mm-hmm.
And so I find that I like that because the person becomes a little bit more numb because it stops some of the nerve transmission. It also makes it easier. It seems to interfere with the bond to the tooth, so it comes off much easier, and it seems to soften it. So the cleaning is a lot easier. But then, you know, I'll often, when I get done, go ahead and put some more under their gums. And, you know, if a person has gum disease, what we're always looking for is for the tissues to reattach to the tooth. And it does that, I call it a Velcro-like attachment. It does that through these little fibroblasts in the gums, and they just zip back onto the tooth. Well, several things get in the way of that, like if they're a smoker, you know, that doesn't happen. If they have a lot of sugars in their diet, those little fibroblasts, kind of, it's like they're drunk, they can't find their home base. So I always encourage my people not to have sugar, you know, for a while, at least after that. But ozone helps make a bazillion more fibroblasts so that you're going to get a stronger, better tissue attachment. And fibroblasts themselves release some healing factors and so on. So it's definitely involved in healing in a lot of ways. And then I tell just about every patient to get some at home, you know, get some of this O3 skincare or Premier Research Labs are two good ozonated oils, and then get these little gum soft picks that can be bought at any store. The ozonated oils are a little bit harder to buy, but they can be found online. But these gum soft picks are everywhere, and I'll take about a quarter of a pea size out and put it on a plate and then dip the other end in and just, you know, use it like a toothpick in between my teeth. And, again, they're going to raise their health in their mouth if they do that. It's just a little extra insurance. I still encourage flossing, but
now the one
it's
that,
pretty wonderful.
The brand that you use, is that is the oil in the form of a liquid, or is it really more like a coconut oil where it's kind of solid?
Well, coconut oil is solid because it's saturated, you know, but it even will go liquid in the summer. So most of these are kind of follow that. They're more solid in the winter, but if they get warm, they're going to be a little bit more liquidy. So I keep mine in the refrigerator, though, just to keep its longevity. Although it'll last 7 or 8 years, I mean, it'll always be good. In other words,
when you said that it numbs the nerve, is that a lasting effect or is that a temporary?
Oh no, it's temporary. It just slows down nerve transduction for a while. So I bet 2 or 3 times in my 30-odd year career have I ever had a person completely numbed, and none really in the last 10 or 15. I mean, that was in my early career. So, and of course that's not all due to ozone, but it people are much more comfortable when you use it.
In the oil, you can use it in your mouth and not have to worry about breathing it in because its form has been changed once it goes through the oil.
It is, and you're not putting that much in there, and you're swallowing some of it, and it's not enough to, I mean, a quarter of a pea size is not very much at all. And before we get off of this one, they also make these little rubber tips, so if somebody has a deep pocket that's accessible with a rubber tip, mm-hmm. they can put a little bit of that ozone on and get it in there, and quite often the tissue will reattach.
Wow.
And then, of course, you know, your hygienist, if she has or dentist, if there's an ozone machine available, you can use the gas, and that's more profound. If you have a framework of bone and you can't always see whether it's there on an X-ray or not because sometimes bone has lost so much density it's not apparent, but if you use the ozone pretty regularly, the bone, it will stimulate bone, not regeneration, but, you know, the density will increase significantly, and who wouldn't want that? You know?
Right. I was under the impression that it could do osteogenesis from Dr. Malika, but I'm not positive about that.
And he's the expert, so my impression was, though, there has to be some mild amount of framework there. Again, maybe not visible on the X-ray, but maybe it does, you know. I guess it wouldn't surprise me. I've certainly seen pictures where on an X-ray it looks like there's no bone in one picture, and they've been using it rather, you know, steadily, and voila, you know, there is a lot of bone there.
Mm-hmm. So while we're still on the topic of ozone, do you ever use ozonated water in the practice?
I think it's important to use ozonated water if you're using, say, an ultrasonic. You know, it's my favorite way. You know, I know different doctors will put in maybe an essential oil or, you know, chlorhexidine or something like that. But chlorhexidine, it's used for gum disease, but I don't understand why, because it inhibits fibroblast function, and if you want the tissues to reattach to the tooth. I mean, they're doing it for the bacterial control, but, you know, you've got to look that it's a bigger picture than that. So I don't like chlorhexidine, and I don't like the essential oils. I mean, I don't think there's been enough study to show what impedes, you know, one of the things you'd wanted to talk about today was adhesive dentistry.
Yeah.
You know, and since most people are moving away from mercury fillings, we need to get more serious about adhesive dentistry and what makes for a good bond and what does not make for a good bond and what makes for failure. And so you have to have, I would say ozonated water would be the best way to keep the water line clean and still allow a good bond.
Mm.
There may be other ways, but to me that seems like it's the most safe. So,
would you like to talk about the adhesive dentistry now?
Sure. Adhesive dentistry is... It's fascinating. You know, I've become pretty close with the biomimetic dentist in the United States because the way adhesive dentistry is frequently done, you know, the filling preps are the same shape as they've always been, you know. I mean, it's like Frank Lloyd Wright, you know. He didn't like, in architecture, he's like, why are we building these same old structures when we've got these amazing new materials, you know? And so he struck out and started doing crazy things with, you know, the steel and glass that was available. Well, adhesive dentistry is the same way. We don't need to have the same old, you know, square preps that we've been doing for the last 150 years. So let's step back a second and talk about air abrasion dentistry and microdentistry. Most people don't necessarily like to go to the dentist because they don't like the shots, right? They're afraid or something like that. And one of the things about using air abrasion is quite often there is no anesthetic that's needed. You're not generating heat. You're not stimulating the pulp in any way. So that's not necessary. But beyond that, so air abrasion, let me just explain what it is. It's basically like sandblasting the teeth. And what's beautiful about it is that it's very selective about what it removes. It pretty much only removes compromised tooth structure. And I think that's a wonderful advantage. What, you know, the old-fashioned preps were used a drill that create these sharp angled sides that were bigger at the bottom than the top. And when that tooth is subjected to function, you know, we chew with several hundred pounds of pressure, it develops these little crack lines right at the base of that. I mean, it's so predictable. I mean, I can't think of anyone very much that's had a you know, the center of the tooth cored out and used that tooth for a long time that didn't have a break of the tooth away from the filling. And, of course, that leads to crowns, and, you know, sometimes the crowns lead to root canals, and then the root canals lead to extraction, or, you know, people jump that root canal step if they understand more about root canals. But so with air abrasion, you get these nice, softly contoured sides that just follow, you know, where the decay went. And so you don't get any of these concentrated forces on the tooth. You know, it's able to dissipate the stresses much better. And that's what we really need in tooth function. And then these biomimetic dentists, these adhesive dentists who've really studied it, they know how to layer in these resins in a certain way that they're going, you know, first of all, the material is important. You have different layers in the tooth. You have the dentin, which is highly organic and can pass forces through the tooth, and then you have the enamel, which is much harder and can't do that. So you want to have two different materials that you use, one that mimics the dentin and one that mimics the enamel. And then they have to be put in a certain way. And you know, that bond is so critical, or that resin filling itself will also fail. So it's pretty tricky, you know, there's no time to go into it here. It's, you know, it's a whole course, but
sure.
It's a place where I would like to see dentists moving to understand that a little bit better. So.
And so there's,
I encourage any listening dentist to look at the Academy of Biomimetic Dentistry or my website, www.mouthmattersbook.com. There's a pretty extensive discussion of that.
And so they use two separate types of filling materials, one to mimic the dentin and one to mimic the enamel.
Yes, and they usually only will fill two sides at a time, for instance. Again, that gets into something called C-factor, which is just... It's complicated, and they have to know where to apply the light. They also understand that not only do you have to have clean water, but you have to have clean air, and that's why you're overlooked in dentistry. You know, we have contaminated airlines that, you know, you can use ozone all you want, and if you blow the tooth dry at the very end with a contaminated air, you're going to probably have some lubricant, you know, particles in there, and you're going to have some bacteria in there, and you just seal it in, and I just think that affects bond strength. So pretty soon on my website, I have a friend who's working on a plug-and-play model, you know, for dentists where they can, you know, they don't have to put these systems together by themselves. So far there isn't anything commercially available, but I think that's one of the places that adhesive dentistry needs to go.
What is some of the causes for gum disease that we had talked about just a moment ago of treating it with the ozone, but what do people want to do to avoid developing it in the first place?
Gum disease to me is a symptom of a body in trouble, let's put it that way. Diet, as you know, is the base of just about every disease. You know, almost every disease. So... again, if you have a diet that's high in sugars and you have the wrong kinds of fats and you don't get the right, you know, nutrients, your body's not going to operate correctly. And so I have, you know, people keep thinking it's all about tooth cleaning. And, yeah, that plays into it, both what they do at home and what we do in the dental office. But I also have people who eat very cleanly. And I expect your viewers or listeners know what that means. You know, the grass-fed animals, and right? You've talked extensively about that, I expect.
Right.
Yes, you're
and
going to have...
Like Dr. Mercola was saying, he still has problems with the tartar.
Oh, yes, but that was interesting. And what you know, you may have seen my interview with him, which is, I think, what sparked this. But
yes.
What you didn't know
yes,
is what happened afterwards, is that I peeked in his mouth afterwards and... back to the front of the conversation that we had today, this man knows how to eat correctly. He knows how to exercise. I mean, he's fit. But what he didn't have going for him was a mobile tongue. So when I looked under his tongue, he was so tongue-tied that his tongue couldn't rest on the roof of his mouth correctly. He couldn't swallow correctly. I mean, it was pretty serious, and he jumped right on it. He got hooked up with Joy Moeller, who trained me, and he released his tie. I think that, you know, and again, we didn't discuss carbon dioxide and so on, but I expect that at night he was a mouth breather. And we have to look at not just daytime, I mean, but nighttime, what's happening. Are we mouth breathers at night? Because so I didn't tie this together. When we are mouth breathers, this is a huge... release of carbon dioxide. You know, you breathe at twice the rate, you breathe at twice the volume, you blow off way too much carbon dioxide. So you don't have enough to, like I said, pop the oxygen off the hemoglobin, to relax your blood vessel walls. And more importantly, you don't have enough to combine with hydrogen ions in your body to form the bicarbonate that buffers the body. So I'm guessing that that had a lot to do with his tartar. And again, you know, his amount of acceptable tartar, you know, there's a broad range of what people call a lot of tartar. He probably just likes to be immaculate. But, you know, he is not my client, and so I don't really know what that is. But I also, I'm trying to think of what I saw in there. I don't think he has any metal in his mouth anymore, but I will say that when people have metal in their mouth, I do think that precipitates a lot more of the minerals out into the plaque.
Mm.
So you see, it's pretty complicated.
Oh, it sure is. And it's, you can't have a linear discussion about it because it's really not a, something that can be reduced or distilled to a single protocol because we're these dynamic beings.
Everybody is different. That's right. But I suspect that, you know, I'm pretty sure he's using ozonated oil in his mouth after our interview, and I think he'll also have some benefit from that. So, yeah, but he said that that was one of the best things he's done in a long time. He was very excited by his myofunctional therapy. His posture is better. I think he must, since he's swallowing better, you know, a lot of people who swallow incorrectly swallow a lot of air, so they get reflux and digestive issues and burping, and, you know, that's huge for a lot of people. So, and then mouth breathers, you know, there's a whole other thing that goes with it. You get really dry in the mouth. And, you know, saliva is a really important component of keeping neutralized in there. And, you know, bugs love a dry environment, you know, the dehydration. I mean, it's not dry enough to where the bugs die. It's just going to be a very acidic environment. And, and so that's a pretty negative situation.
Can we talk a little bit about biofilms and how they come into existence and how to remediate biofilms that develop in the mouth?
Yes. Biofilms are going to form anywhere there's water. You just can't avoid it, and they form in about 19 hours. I keep thinking I'm going to post a biofilm formation thing so you can see it. It's fascinating just how quickly they form. A lot of people are worried about the germs, but basically germs are not a problem until they form into a biofilm, which is a conglomeration of germs. It's a community, if you will. It's made of 50% germs and 50% kind of the glue, if you will, that glues them onto the tooth. And once they become, you know, involved in a biofilm, our bodies can't really fight them. They're pretty unable to be responded to, chemically and biologically, they can't be attacked very well. They're very protective of themselves. So basically what we have to do is mechanical removal. So there's where the brushing into the gums goes, and I keep saying I'm going to post, you know, I've tried to describe my way of brushing so that people can get under the gums a little bit better, but I think I just need to do a video of it and post it. But you have to clean under the gums. You can take that little rubber tip that I was talking about under the gums, but, you know, there's a certain way of brushing that will get into the gums, and then flossing to either side of the gums. But again, you know, the ozonated oils help with the biofilm. So,
now, I feel that I could get under the gums along the outside or inside of the teeth, but I don't really understand how I could get under the gums in between the teeth.
You mean with the ozone?
No, I mean with brushing.
Oh, not with brushing. You don't. You have to floss.
Okay.
Flossing is what does that. And it slips in between the tooth and the gum if you do it correctly.
Okay.
And again, you know, I need to throw a video up just to make it a little bit more obvious because, you know, I've seen a lot of patients that have been seen, well, let's not get into that. A lot of times people don't know how to floss. And,
right.
And it's important. So, So biofilms are what you really want to worry about. And you wanted to talk for, I think we're running out of time, so you wanted to talk about remineralization. I wonder if there are reasons why I'm not crazy about remineralization from the outside of the tooth, because there are three ways that I go into in my book that demineralization comes from the inside of the tooth. And a lot of times, you know, like these fluoride advocates, they're looking for fluoride to hit the outside of the tooth and strengthen the outside. But that seems to me to deflect x-rays differently, and it's harder then to recognize what's going on internally into a tooth. I think it sometimes delays diagnosis. And it doesn't rebuild the structure of the tooth. You know, once a tooth, so you were asking about biofilms. Biofilms not only cause gum disease, but when they sit on the tooth, of course, they're going to create acids that pull minerals out. And what they do is that that structure then is an amorphous structure. It's no longer crystalline. It's not intact, and so the acids that sit there can diffuse through that demineralized area, and if that demineralized area goes into the next layer of the tooth or the dentin, then that becomes kind of a self-propagating loss of minerals that you could call decay, but it just doesn't have anything to do with the bacteria anymore. That's a significant thing to know. There turns out, however, and that's one of the reasons why I like ozone, because ozone can penetrate the tooth 4 to 5 millimeters. It can kill all the germs in there, but more importantly, it can deactivate the germs' end products, which are acidic. So now the tooth with, you know, with its if it has a live pulp, can bring minerals up through the center of it, bring it out through the tooth, and harden it from the inside out. Now, that's the kind of remineralization that I like.
Wow.
So I like ozone with that. Mm-hmm. But if you really like remineralization, there is a 20 nanometer. Our teeth are made of calcium hydroxyapatite. And, you know, they try to throw all sorts of different remineralization things at it, for instance, fluoride. But the tooth does not, like I said, regain its crystalline structure. So you've got this hard outside, but so what? If you use the same material as the tooth is made of, and it's the right shape and size, this is pretty new, called a 20 nanometer calcium hydroxyapatite, then the tooth actually does become more stable. It does build up that crystalline structure again, and when you have that crystalline structure, it's able to put up with the stresses of chewing and all the things that a tooth is called on to do. So the only thing right now, I'd love to get Dr. Mercola to start incorporating that in his product. That would take some time, but, you know, I've been thinking about talking to him about it. Right now it's only found in Carafree, and I didn't really like Carafree so much because they put fluoride in their product as well. However, it occurred to me the other day to look and see they have a baby's toothpaste or a children's toothpaste that doesn't have it. So, you know, your people listening may want to try out that Carafree, and it's available more in the Northeast. You know, people on other coasts probably have to buy it on the Internet. But anyway, that would be the child's version.
And so that works topically, not systemically?
Absolutely, yeah. So that does, again, that works from the outside in, but at least it does help to restructure that that demineralized area. And a lot of people don't know what that looks like. Basically, if they have a tooth where they've left plaque on it for a long time, they'll see a white spot underneath. It's just super white. A lot of times you'll find it along the gum line or where orthodontic brackets are. And that is a demineralized area that's lost its tooth structure. So
and
my favorite is to use ozone with that.
And so that's something that you want to use on the enamel. That's not something that's used when you have decay that's gone into the dentin?
Correct. Correct. At that point, well, you know, a little bit of air abrasion, ozone. I might mention that I have a database of doctors on my website that do air abrasion, ozone, and biomimetic dentistry. Not all of them do all of it, and the real problem there is not all of them understand biocompatibility. You know, so you know, there's so much to know in dentistry, and what I really want to do is help these dentists understand biocompatibility with the body, because that's critically important to a lot of people. So,
and what
you might have a lot of. Go ahead.
And what I'd like to do is let the listeners know that they have options and what they are, so that they can, you know, go to your website, look at these dentists, you know, go to some of the other websites of other dentists I've interviewed so they can see that they're not, you know, limited to just what someone locally knows about.
Yeah, a traditional dentist, you know. I mean, I worked in that world for so long, and it's just, it's so foreign to me now. I think the other thing, though, I really, it's important to educate themselves on all the different options because, you know, there's no perfect option. It's unfortunate. Once you've lost, you know, something, it's hard to replace it perfectly. You're going to have to start making compromises, and so you have to decide which compromises are ones you're willing to make. And then, you know, my struggle is I'm trying to help make dentistry kind of better as far as, you know, getting different sections of doctors understanding each other a little bit better so they can start looking at, say, biocompatibility or biomimetics or something they haven't considered before. So, of course, I'm going to push my book a little bit because I really believe that a lot of the things I bring up in it are things that I want the general I wrote it for the general public. I know it's very detailed. You know, a person doesn't have to read and know every last little bit of it, but gather what's important to them and don't be afraid to ask their doctor, say, well, you know, I read about this. This is what I'm looking for. What do you think we can do? You know, that's how we change things, by what we ask for.
Right.
So.
Well, thank you for taking the time to speak with me this morning. I really appreciate it. And, your book is Mouth Matters, and the website is mouthmattersbook.com. And if anyone is out there looking for it, your name is Carol Vanderstoep.
Yes, thank you for listening and for interviewing me. It's been fun. I know that we were all over the map, but like you said, there's a lot to talk about.
Yes.